everyone, and welcome to Heavy Pod as Heavy Casts. This is a little bit of an unusual situation here. So I'm going to be traveling this week, so I probably won't be able to record a full episode of the podcast. So as such, I've decided to kind of try an experiment that I've been wanting to try for a while, which is I'm just sitting in my car driving to work right now, and I wanted to just record this by myself and see how this goes. And maybe this is a disaster. Maybe this never airs. Maybe I end up recording this week anyway and we just post a regular podcast. But I feel like I'm going to eventually upload this one. So we'll see how it goes. So how do we format a solo podcast, right? It's how do I talk for like 30, 40 minutes and make it like not miserably boring and not stutter, not, you know, catch myself trying to speak? Well, the answer is I have no fucking idea. But I've listened to a bunch of podcasts with this format. The one that I listen to regularly is Drive to Work by Mark Rosewater. Mark Rosewater is the lead designer of Magic the Gathering, and he does these episodes where he just, you know, on his drive to work every week, like two episodes, I believe. He talks about his thoughts on, you know, design or some retrospective on some, you know, set that he designed. So for him, you know, he's a creative fountain in that sense, so he can easily talk about it. For me, you know, well, I do create stuff, but that's not necessarily why people listen to the podcast, I think. It's more about kind of editorial opinion, air quotes. So for me, it's a little bit more challenging. But the thing is, there are some ideas that I've been kind of gestating in the back of my head in terms of topics that I want to cover that I never get around to talking about with Eden, or I don't have the time to put down to an article, or it's just that the idea itself doesn't really kind of coagulate in my head clearly enough for it to be turned into an article. So maybe talking it out will be kind of interesting and see where it goes, right? So the idea is that I made this playlist of my favorite songs from the year so far, and one of the songs is Reptile by Periphery. I know me and Periphery may be a bit surprising, but I really like that song. And I think, you know, Hail Stan or whatever is one of their better albums. And I've been listening to Reptile. Obviously the most notable thing about that track is that it's a 17-minute song. But it's, you know, I think it flows well. It's kind of energetic and it has interesting sections and it just has motifs that it repeats. So I think it's cool to listen to. But the more interesting thing about it is that not only is it a 17-minute song, but it's also the first song on the album. So this led me to kind of think about this notion of a really long song for the opener of your album. And I kind of tried to do that with The Upper Youth Existence on my album. It was like a 7-minute song. But, you know, I didn't fully commit to it, I guess. And I had like an intro track that was kind of added last minute. Probably if I do another album one day, I'm probably going to follow through with this idea. But it's a pretty challenging idea because, you know, you want... So the first track is like the first impression many people will have of the album. And I've sent my album to many outlets for their review or consideration or whatever. And oftentimes the feedback I get is, you know, mostly on the first one or two songs. After that, they kind of clearly tune out and they've kind of formed their opinion. So the idea is that if your first song is super, super long, then that is going to, you know, potentially put a lot of people off. Because, you know, they'll get bored of it and then want to switch. Or, you know, if they're not already into kind of your sound that you're going for, like a really extravagant, really long version of that is not going to be particularly appealing either. It's going to be more of a turn-off, in fact. So I think there's kind of two kinds of artists who can pull this off, I think. You either have the, like, really well-established artist, like Periphery, who can kind of afford to take the hit because they know that people are going to listen to the album anyway, so they can be kind of self-indulgent and just throw in, like, a really ridiculous track for the opener. And the other is, you know, artists that are, like, for lack of a better term, like, 3-prog 5U, you know, really prog artists who are kind of really into the heavily progressive, heavily technical, heavily long, overindulgent song style anyway. So for them, you know, it's almost like a statement of intent, right? For them, it's more along the lines of, oh yeah, this is what we're doing, and if you're not into this, like, good luck, because you're not going to be the rest of it anyway. So while the Periphery song is kind of what spurned on this idea, you know, Adam Neely always says repetition legitimizes, right? So the idea is that if there's one example, it's kind of an interesting outlier, but if there's more of it, then that kind of becomes a theme. So for me, what turned this idea into a theme was, you know, one of my favorite albums, Machine Heads and Blackening. And that was actually the first time I kind of conceived of this idea as a concrete thing to begin with. And what I'm talking about here is Clenching the Fists of Dissent, which is the opener for that album. And I think it's like, wait, maybe 14 minutes long? I might be wrong. But like over 10 minutes long for sure. And it's, I think it's even more stark here than Periphery's Reptile, because Periphery kind of at heart are a prog band, whereas Machine Head are kind of like a groove metal thrash kind of band, and they don't typically do a lot of super long songs. They kind of have this thing where their songs feel long because they have a lot of sections, especially with the series of albums from Through the Ashes of Empires, Blackening, Locust, and Bloodstone and Diamonds. Like those four albums, you know, had them kind of flirting with some progressive ideas, but they were never like really a full-on prog band. And I think Clenching the Fists of Dissent is their longest song to date still, by far, if I remember correctly. So opening an album with this is actually pretty brave. And they're on Roadrunner Records at the time. And they were, you know, Machine Head's career trajectory was so that they started off with like a really strong album, Burn My Eyes, back in the 90s. And then they made a bunch of so-called new metal albums that a lot of people didn't really like. So when they came back with Ashes of Empires, they had something to prove. And they proved it, right? They got back into recognition. But then the Blackening, it was like a make it or break it album, because like you have one album that is successful, but what turns that into, again, repetition legitimizes, right? So like if you follow that up with a second good album, then it's kind of a thing, right? Then it becomes, oh, they're a good band and not just a fluke. So the Blackening was, I think, pretty critical to Machine Head. And, you know, they had a lot of songs from that album that are all-time classics for them, like Halo, Aesthetics of Hate. There was another one. It was on Guitar Hero or something like that. It wasn't Guitar Hero, Metallica, I think, actually. Beautiful Morning, right? Yeah. Clenching of the Fists of Dissent was a really bold move for Machine Head, I would say, despite them being a pretty large band on a pretty large label. In fact, maybe because of that, it's a bigger deal because, you know, the audience that they're appealing, Periphery has always kind of appealed to like a progressive audience, right? That's where they got their start. And even though they're like a lot more mainstream nowadays, still the kind of the prog audience is their bread and butter. With Machine Head, they're appealing to like a really large, really mainstream audience. They're you know, it's like the audience that has like Lambo God. It has like the Hot Topic audience, right? So Clenching the Fists of Dissent was like a big statement from them. And I think they totally pulled it off. They totally killed it. And it doesn't even feel that long of a song. And I think Reptile has a similar vibe too, where like, it's not that the song feels super long. It's just that it's kind of a more, you know, deluxe version of a regular one of their songs, it feels like, right? Like, maybe there's a few more sections, maybe some sections get elaborated a little bit longer, but it doesn't feel like this ridiculous progressive journey where you go through, like, all kinds of nonsense, right? So the other end of the spectrum, you have stuff like Native Construct, where their first song is mute. And actually, like, what turned Native Construct into a band was they made a YouTube video, which was a playthrough of Chromatic Aberration. That's the name of the song, right? The, like, 12-minute long last song on the album. Like, that was the first thing that they made, and then that got a lot of traction on YouTube in the prog circles because it was super cool and really clever. And then, over time, that kind of spiraled out into the album. And, you know, we've had Miles on the podcast, and we talked about it, and, you know, they kind of wrote it around that. So while they're, you know, their debut was essentially this long progressive song, and then they made an album, and then of course the first song on Mute is like what, 7 or 9 minutes long or something like that. So again, it's like, in this case, it's making the statement of, okay, we're really progressive. We're going to take you on this long-ass journey. It's going to be a wild ride. You know, there's going to be ups and downs. Mute has, like, synths. It has blast beats. It has, like, quirky, clean guitar parts and whatnot. So there, it's more of a statement. And you could argue that it's kind of a gimmick, but there's a little bit more to it than that. Like, when you're a progressive band, you kind of have to stake out the ground, like I said. And there's so many prog bands out there. And you have to, like, you know, essentially you're kind of putting it all on black or whatever, like some bizarre gambling term or whatever, right? You're basically, you're going all in. I don't fucking know anything about gambling, so. You're basically making a bold statement and hoping that it sticks. And I think, like, you know, Quiet World was a big success for Native Construct. And, you know, the band disbanded, but it's not that they didn't succeed. It's that, you know, for other reasons. But I think Mute was a strong statement and it paid off. And, you know, it gained, like, a cult following. It's, you know, it was a statement of the band and it was a statement that succeeded. Another example is, you know, an album that you and I talk about on the podcast a lot. Back to Time Splendor by Disillusion. And the first song on that, And the Mirror Cracked, is again like 7 to 9 minutes long. I don't remember the exact number. And, you know, most of the songs on the album are long. And, you know, the upcoming Disillusion album, I forget the name of it now, but that one also opens with a long song and has a bunch of long songs. So, yeah, I think this is, for progressive bands, if you're making good music, it's going to pay off. And, you know, it's not that every time you make a long song, you're destined to succeed, because it's a high-risk, high-reward kind of situation for the progressive bands, because if the song's not great, then, it's not going to pay off. So, yeah, for progressive bands, I think it is a bold move that if you're talented, you can pull off, and pulling it off means that you'll succeed. Like, the first song that really sold me on Leprous was Forced Entry, which is a 10-minute song. It's not the first song on the album, but it's what I first heard from them, which made me decide to check the rest of their stuff out. I think the first song on Cold, Foe, is like 5 minutes long. But then the album ends with a long song. So ending with a long song or having a long song in the difference is also cool. But it's not, you know, the same type of statement as just starting off with like a full-blown, epic, ridiculous song. And I don't think even Dream Theater have, and I'm probably wrong here actually, but like Dream Theater haven't really had an album where like the longest song is the first one. This isn't the same thing as like the whole album is one song kind of deal where like Insomnium's Winter's Gate or some other prog bands. Like, that's like a different type of thing that you're going through there. And there you can like make any song as long as you want. It doesn't really matter because it's kind of part of a whole. So artists don't tend to make, you know, the longest song the first one for like the obvious reasons that I've stated earlier. So I think this is a completely different phenomenon than the other types of, you know, progressive overindulgence, where you're putting kind of more on the line, I think. So going back to the kind of non-progressive artists doing this, I had a few other examples of this off the top of my head. I cannot remember them right now. I mean, I think this is definitely a cool phenomenon, and this is something that we'll probably further explore when we have more of a back and forth going on. But I think we've laid the groundwork, and I'd be interested in hearing what Eden thinks about this, and I'd be interested in hearing, you know, hey, post in the comments, like, hit that MF like button, you know, subscribe, whatever. Right, so that's one of the topics that I was thinking of covering. Okay, so another topic that I've been wanting to cover is the notion of, and again, this is kind of based on my favorite songs of 2019 playlist, the notion of creativity in a, like, metalcore, groove metal, djent, whatever kind of band, where the type of band where, you know, most of their songs are just And I don't mean this in a derogatory fashion, you know. Most of their songs are just a lot of chugging. Maybe like a chorus here or there. But I was thinking, like, if I were to write, like, I was listening to the song Drown in Ruin by Heart of a Coward. And I think Heart of a Coward is one of the best, like, just pure chug groove bands out there. Their album, can't remember the name. Deliverance. Was it Deliverance or was it the one after that? I can't remember. But the last album before the most recent one is, I think, one of the best, like, pure chugging energy albums out there. And it's really interesting. Like, I was listening to the song and I thought to myself, like, could I write a whole album of this? And I don't think I can. I legitimately would just be completely out of it, like completely out of riffs and ideas and whatnot to write. And that made me realize and, like, it made me kind of appreciate the creativity. And I know, like, it's kind of a idea that's maligned a lot of, oh, there's no creativity, you know, they're just playing open trugs, whatever. But it's kind of a different kind of creativity, I think, that goes into being able to do this and still have kind of... So, I mean, you're kind of in between a rock and a hard place, right? Because on one hand, you have to have, like, a consistent sound. You know, you have to be recognizable as, oh, this is Heart of a Coward, and not be generic. On the other hand, you have to be creative within, like, this really tight space of, you know, you have chugs for the verse, and then, like, maybe a few chords for the chorus, and then, like, a solid breakdown, and the song ends. Like, this is actually, like, a really hard writing challenge, and if I were to challenge myself to write like this, I don't think I'd be able to write, like, more than maybe, like, 3-4 songs without, like, being extremely half-assed. And these dudes have, like, made a whole career out of it. You know, they're, like, 5 albums or whatever. And they're not the only artists, right? There's... So another one of my favorite albums from this year is the new Gravemind album, Conduit, I think. And that's similar. Like, they do so much with so little. There's more to Gravemind's sound than Heart of a Coward, but still. And last year we had Krosis' Soul and Bottom, and that was, again, a similar idea. And bands like Monuments, for example, don't really count towards this, I think, because Monuments put in, like, a lot more prog elements to their sound. So they have kind of more to work with, whereas something like Heart of a Coward is, like, a really, really streamlined sound. And I sat down to think about, you know, what is creativity? Like, how do these guys kind of spice up their songs? And by the way, I just realized it's ironic to go from, like, 10-minute long prog songs, that's like a tongue twister, as my first topic, to, like, hyper-condensed chug metal songs as my second. But anyway, so I think it's interesting to sit down and think about, like, what these guys do to kind of have their trademark sound while still being able to kind of be creative and write more stuff. So what they, I mean, and, you know, there's a million bands that do this kind of thing, but I think the reason why a band like Heart of a Coward actually stands out is because that they're able to be creative and, like, they're able to kind of express themselves while still sticking to these norms, whereas other bands, I'm not going to name names because, like, there's, you know, many, many bands who kind of fall into this trap. But there's other bands who just don't really put in that same amount of effort, and they kind of just stick to tropes, and thus they end up being, like, super, super stale. So Heart of a Coward, I think there's a few really key elements. The drumming is a huge part of it. And it made me kind of appreciate drumming more in that, the drummer needs to know when to stick to the chugs and when to break off. And we talked about this last week, with the Unprocessed album, and where the drummer, you know, doesn't do the typical djent thing. So it's more interesting. But yeah, so the Heart of a Coward drummer, he doesn't have, like, one feel that he always goes to, which, again, that's, like, a pitfall for these type of bands. He really uses fills and syncopation well to kind of... So you can essentially take this one riff on the guitars, play the same way, and, like, drums can essentially, like, elaborate on that riff differently to give it, like, feel, make it feel a lot more varied, right? You could be playing just the kicks on the... The kicks on the chugs and, like, a 4-4 and 1-2-3-4 kind of hi-hat snare pattern, And that is one thing. They could go like halftime to give it more of a kind of heavier, kind of breakdown-y vibe. They could go like off time and like give it kind of a more progressive vibe. And that really kind of helps them take, because their verses in the end are like one chug pattern usually. That really helps them take that one pattern and then expand on it to make it last longer throughout the song. Because if you're just doing it the same way over and over, it's going to get stale. And then another thing, then this is a thing that I employ in my own songs a lot. Let me make some change. Is that you want to have your riff, kind of like this is, I'm trying to remember the official term in poetry. I can't remember, but like, you know, you want to have your riff where the ending of the riff varies every time you do it so that it doesn't give you the same repetitive feeling over and over, right? So it's like, 1, 2, 3, 4, A, 1, 2, 3, 4, B, 1, 2, 3, 4, A, 1, 2, 3, 4, C, right? So again, going back to Adam Healy, repetition legitimizes the A repeating there and the 1, 2, 3, 4 repeating there grounds the riff, but then the B and C kind of break out from it and give it variation. I don't remember in which Adam Neely video exactly does this repetition legitimizes thing began, but like, you know, he made it a theme and kind of, it's kind of a self-justifying meme, right? Where he keeps saying it and it becomes more and more legitimate every time. So yeah, I think bands that have a particular, so this applies to prog bands too. And in prog bands, you have motifs, right? You kind of introduce an idea and you elaborate on it and you come back on it later. But within the space of a chug four band, you have way less room to be able to do this. So you have to be much more economical with it. And Heart of a Coward have, I think, like really had it down to like a science of how to kind of economize this and how to best apply this kind of essentially like adding flares to their riffs. And as such, they're able to, like, again, get a lot more mileage out of, like, the same types of riffs within the course of the song. And then the next aspect is ambience. Not ambience, C-E, but ambient, T-S. So having these kind of little ambience, like, overdub guitar sounds, like, you know, maybe, like, an octave sound, maybe, like, this, like, really low-volume kind of droning thing going on in the background. Maybe a little bit of a synth, maybe like a, you know, like bass drop or whatever. And obviously these are things that every artist uses, but Heart of a Coward use it again, like really economically to, because, okay, so as a, all right, I'm getting ahead of myself. So let me explain, right? So the idea is that, you know, during your chorus, you had a few extra guitars, but during your, to kind of, you know, give it a bigger vibe, or during your verse, you kind of, you know, add maybe like a droning rhythmic thing in the background to kind of make it feel a bit more rhythmic. But here's the thing, like, as a person who's recorded an album with like so many tracks, the problem is when you go into like the big mode, like you have your chorus with like a million instruments, then you go back to your verse, it sounds really empty and really bland and lifeless. So the problem with applying these types of things, especially in a really economical framework such as a chug core band, is that the moment you apply a thing and then you don't, the parts where you don't apply it sound just empty. So how do you deal with this? If you kind of tried to overcompensate and apply it everywhere and you have the constantly ambience going, then it becomes a overwhelming mush. It becomes like really fatiguing to listen to. And you're not able to have that really like punchy feeling of, you know, okay, now it's going really raw, really heavy. You don't have that because there's constantly this kind of noise going on that's like polluting the production, and you're not able to like harness the kind of energy. So Heart of a Coward, again, did this really interestingly and intelligently in that they are able to kind of have this structure where it keeps building throughout the song. The chorus is like a climax, and then right after the chorus, they have like a pre-verse almost sometimes, where it's like super back to basics. It like brings it down. They get rid of everything. Maybe there's like one guitar or like maybe that's a really simple riff, and then they go back into the verse, and that kind of resets. So that like you have this like build up throughout the chorus, you climax, you get really energetic, and then slow down for a little bit, and then back to the like the verse, and then keeps building again and again. And then the breakdown, in the breakdown, they usually have this like, you know, the drums go back like really slow. They really pare back. Like, they go half time, they go quarter time. And the guitars have this like kind of open chug, not in the open note sense, but like, you know, you, dum, dum. So like they have this like, they establish like a long note and then like chop it off with a fast note at the end. So there's like a lot of room in the sound, and the drums are, you know, pared back. And then here they can again introduce some like ambience to kind of make it feel fuller. So this way they can kind of, essentially they're like really controlling the amount of stuff going on in the song. And again, being economical with it to be able to kind of, they're like harnessing the amount of energy that you have throughout the song, and they're kind of playing with you, right? Like, I just realized like last night I was working out at the gym. And like, this is like a really small gym, and I know like the trainer, so like I can control the music at the gym sometimes. And like it was playing some really generic like house electronic music. It was like a simple beat, and it was okay. But then I was like, hey, can I play a song? And then I made them play some Grime. It was Holy Grime by Wiley and Devlin. One of the best Grime songs from last year. Or was it 2016? Anyway, Wiley, big Grime legend, shout out. Anyway, and like, I was like running out of energy. It was like 9 p.m. But then this song came out. It was like a super aggressive, energetic song. And like, I knocked out like a whole round of sets, super fast, super energetic. And I realized like, music that can kind of take charge of your energy really like in a fashion that is like, you know, really directed and well crafted can really energize you. And like, Heart of a Coward, I think, are a band that do this super, super well. And they're like, so the, what was the name of that album? God damn it. I think the album is Deliverance, and the song Hollow from that album is a really good example of it. The production, the instrumentation, the how the band comes together, it all kind of comes together to basically like control energy in a really direct fashion. And I think like sometimes this is why people feel that some like hardcore songs are heavier than death metal songs, because like death metal, a lot of death metal is like always on all the time. And that's a different kind of energy, right? You're just like constantly pummeling and like constantly fast, but the ability to kind of pare it back down and then bring it back up and like having more room to kind of go faster, slow, I think is also a different kind of energy. And Heart of a Coward again are really good at this. So there's one aspect of the music that we didn't really talk about so far, and that's the vocals. And so Heart of a Coward have a new vocalist on this latest album. He's actually a Turkish guy. Khan is his name. But like he has a different singing style. He has a much higher voice. He sings a lot more, but he still kind of has the same, how do I put this? Compositional acuity, I guess, as the previous guy. I don't remember his name. But so the idea with how the Heart of a Coward again vocals is that obviously like the delivery is really aggressive. But it's not monotonous. Right, you have, he has different voices, and like he can pare it back down. He can like go high with a big clean singing, but more importantly is I think the rhythmic delivery. So it's like the whole band is like a rhythm section in Heart of the Cow, right? The guitars are playing like a particular rhythm, and the drums are accentuating that, and then the vocals are accentuating that more, because the vocals, if you pay attention to kind of the rhythmic flow of the, like the bounce of the whole song, the vocals are like always in line with that and kind of driving that. So the vocals are kind of always kind of charging ahead in the verses. They're always like super on the beat and super like 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, like really kind of this following this energy. Even they're like, even they're not necessarily like super monotonously kind of sticking to the beat per se, but it's just that kind of they're driving the beat. And on the choruses, the guitars usually go onto this like more strummed, slower, big chords, and the vocals always go big, like really the high singing or like really kind of slow, energetic yelling, and it all kind of comes together. So I'm getting to the point where repetition doesn't legitimize, but kind of makes it tedious. So let me kind of bring this together and make my point here. And the idea here is that, you know, there's a lot going on in any piece of music at any given time. You know, even if it's not this, like, ridiculous progressive epic that's, like, 10 minutes long, first song on the album, whatever, right? Just because the music is simplistic and pared down, and you're not playing, like, these extended jazzy chords or, like, really irrational time signatures, doesn't mean that there isn't still a lot going on in the music, and that you shouldn't be paying more attention to your music. Like, just because your music is simplistic chunk chord doesn't mean that you get to, like, you know, write it in and, like, not carefully craft every moment. I mean, you can, but you can do that in prog as well, and the end result is going to be just uncompelling bad music, right? So, and the reason, like, a band like Heart of a Coward stands out from other artists, I think, is that they are able to, they really understand kind of the notion of rhythm and flow, and they're able to kind of carefully craft all these, like, simple components, but, like, by, it's not just, like, what each instrument is doing, but it's how everything is kind of contrasting each other, because the simple example, right, again, is the drums following the chugs versus drums on halftime. The contrast between the drums and the guitar creates completely different vibes. Drums on the chugs gives you like a really like moving forward kind of driving energy. Drums on halftime gives you like a really slow headbang kind of vibe. And it's really interesting to think about how you could take the exact same song and flip the drums around or flip the vocals around and end up in like a completely different vibe. And I think the bands that are able to successfully do this really kind of deserve credit for being able to understand this and make compelling music out of this. And again, like these dudes have like what, four or five albums, each of them had like 10 or more songs. And you can go listen to them and there's always something going on in every song. None of the songs are like, oh, we just like did the same thing again. There's always, they always keep it fresh and within this like really tight framework that they have. And that's not something that everybody can do. Like if you were to have, you know, a prog musician sit down and like do this, they would think that this music is beneath them and like that they can't like the tricks that they would usually go to spice up songs, to keep things interesting. Would be, you know, oh, let's add like a big chord change here, or like a, you know, let's add some like sevenths and ninths onto these chords to make them sound more, you know, complex, or, you know, let's add some like harmonies here or whatever. Like, or, yeah, you get the idea. So like the tricks that they use to kind of spice up songs and keep things interesting would not be applicable here. And even though they think this type of music is kind of beneath them, and not just progressive musicians, but, you know, a lot of metal musicians think, you know, more simplistic music is sometimes beneath them. But there's actually, you know, craft going on here. There is, the musicians are still, you know, they still have to write songs, they still have to keep things interesting, and they still have to, like, engage the listener. And there's still good and bad versions of this music. So clearly, there is talent involved in this. And again, if you sit down, like, Michael Okerfeld, and have him try to write a song like this, he will just burn out after like two songs because, you know, he doesn't have that expertise. And there is expertise here. So my point is that just because something is, you know, simplistic doesn't mean that you should dismiss it immediately. But, you know, you should try to understand what's going on here, like what makes it tick. And I think as a musician, I'm always like analyzing the music I listen to and trying to understand, you know, what they did, why they did it, why it worked or why it didn't work. And how kind of things come together. And it's really fascinating to kind of listen to the music with this type of mindset. And it really frustrates me to hear criticism that's like, oh, you don't like this because you're just like trying to overanalyze it, and like, why can't you just enjoy things? And that's really stupid criticism. Like, it's okay to, you know, enjoy things, but right, because like there's a bunch of like I'm gonna like I don't know, fucking Emir, right? Emir has stuff going on, but so I can't think of like a shitty example of this type of music. Above this versatile. No, that's a hilarious song. But like, if you've ever, like when I was in Baltimore, I would go to local shows, and like there were so many bands, like local bands that were just like playing this like absolutely like bottom of the barrel metalcore. So there's so many bands out there who have this type of sound that don't really kind of put in the same amount of effort per se. Or they, you know, they work hard, but they just don't have the expertise, right? So it's okay to like those bands. You know, there's always something to enjoy in some music. And not everybody's approaching music with a critical mindset, right? But I think it's also important to kind of try to analyze things and, like, separate the things with craft from things without. Like, I don't know if this is like there's a better way to state this, but this is kind of how I think, right? The notion of kind of craft, where you're not just doing something, but you're doing it as a craft. You kind of respect the art. You try to, you know, it's not just a bunch of friends getting together and like shooting the shit and like having some fun, but you're trying. And again, that's perfectly fine. It's fine. It's okay to have fun, but like, I'm trying to make a distinction and I make a case for the notion of craft. And just because you can, like, some people don't care about craft, right? Some people just want to have fun. That's fine. But just because I'm looking at things with a critical lens and trying to understand the craft doesn't mean that I hate fun or I, you know, hate everything or whatever. It's that, to me, there's another dimension of the work being, you know, the song, the movie, the game, whatever. There's another dimension of it that I'm analyzing on that matters to me, where I'm trying to understand the artist, the effort they put into it, and, you know, how they harness their understanding of the art form to create what they created. In fact, I think that this is, you know, respecting the work even more than just being the people who are just like, oh, just have fun. Because you're analyzing it on a whole other perspective and trying to go even deeper into the kind of process of the artist. And, you know, when you start doing this, there's a lot of works out there that don't necessarily stand up. So it's hard to, you know, it's important to be able to kind of tone this back and appreciate things for what they are sometimes, right? Like, I watch, you know, the CW superhero shows, right? And they're, objectively, the craft in them is not as, you know, sublime as something like, I don't know, The Wire, right? Or, yeah. So, that doesn't mean that there's not value in there as well. Like, the people working on that show, they have, because they have a lower budget, right? But they have their own ways of kind of spicing it up. They have their own ways of kind of expressing their craft, right? They, you know, put a lot of effort into kind of engaging with the fan community and kind of giving the fans things to latch onto and kind of little Easter eggs, details, and kind of they revel in their own mythology, and they, you know, they really go all out on kind of creating this universe / multiverse of these shows and having interplay between the shows. And sure, like, maybe the acting isn't as good. The writing is super cheesy sometimes, and, you know, the production design or whatever isn't up to par with something like, you know, the best seasons of Game of Thrones or whatever. but there's still craft to be appreciated within there. And this goes back to kind of, you know, this is like the chug core of TV, right? Like, there is, just because it's simplistic or, you know, there's less going on, there's still, that doesn't mean that there still isn't, love being put into it, craft being put into it. And, you know, stuff like, The Flash stands up from, like, other trash shows, also on the CW, some shows, for example, because, like, other shows don't put the same amount of craft into it. And just because they don't have the same budget or they're going for a cheesy, more pumped type of vibe doesn't mean that, you know, there's not craft. So kind of this notion of distancing craft as a separate axis of analysis that you want to look at any particular work at, because, you know, filming-wise, writing-wise, the show is not as good, but it excels on another axis of, like, you know, engaging with the fans or kind of embracing the low-budget nature and making something out of it anyway. Like, you know, telling stories that would be too cheesy to tell in something like Game of Thrones, but still being interesting. And, like, there's still a place for stories like that, right? Tying this back into music. 7 minute long or 10 minute or 15 minute long prog songs aren't the only type of music that is valuable. There's still room for music like Hunter for Coward. But so by dismissing the kind of lowbrow, in big air quotes, lowbrow type of music, you're erasing the amount of craft that goes into good examples of stuff like that versus the bad examples of it. So yeah, that's my point. You know, just try to analyze every work within its own framework, you know, its own kind of vicinity, and try to examine the craft within it in that context, right? That doesn't mean that you shouldn't analyze it in contrast to everything else, right? Like, you should be analyzing The Flash against Game of Thrones. You should be analyzing Heart of a Coward against Native Construct. But that's a different axis of analysis, is my point. So, yeah, I think this kind of, you know, I went wide, I went deep. You know, I covered two topics that are, like, completely on opposite ends of the spectrum. But I also try to go deep into those, and I kind of try to elaborate on my thoughts. And yeah, I think this was an interesting experiment to try. I think I didn't, you know, stumble too much. I didn't ramble too much. I was able to kind of concisely convey, hopefully, what I wanted to say. And hopefully this worked out. And let me know what you think of this format. I don't think this is a format that we'll be doing regularly. Because A, you know, it's more interesting and fun to do, you know, the back and forth most of the time. And B, I don't necessarily always have the time. You know, I drive to work like maybe once a month. I don't necessarily always have the time to do this, and I don't have necessarily the topics to do this or kind of the energy to, you know, consistently talk about a particular subject or two subjects, whatever, for like half an hour and keep it interesting and not, you know, stutter or get blocked or whatever. Yeah. So this has been fun. Hopefully this has been fun for you, and hopefully the recording like didn't crash and like I just rambled on here by myself for, like, no reason for 40 minutes or 30 or whatever. But yeah, let me know what you thought of this episode. Did you hate it? And again, I also hope that the audio quality wasn't horrible. I'm driving on the highway, but hopefully I'll be able to play with the recording and salvage something out of this. You know, I'm just using my headphones. Yeah, well, with that being said, do any cool people time? Cool people time. Have I done anything cool? I mean, today is like Thursday. We recorded with Eden on Sunday. So in the meantime, have I really done anything? Not really. I guess, topically, I've been watching the seventh season? The most recent, sixth maybe, season of Arrow. I'm not really a fan of it at this point. Like, you know, I think the fifth season of Arrow and the second season of Arrow are fucking fantastic. Like, the first season was good, second season, but, like, the first season, like, has a really slow start, I think. The second season was really good, like, comic book-ass TV. Three, okay, four, eh. The other way around. Four, okay, three, eh. The fifth season was fantastic. Like, the, obviously, like, within the kind of, range of this show, but, like, the villain was, like, incredible. And the whole season kind of tied together kind of the themes of the show. And, like, all the characterization was on point. I really love the fifth season. Sixth season was meh. Like, and the seventh season is more meh. I'm, like, halfway through the season, I think. I've just been, like, kind of slogging through at this point. Just because, you know, I want to see where it goes. Like, next season is going to be the last season, and I just want to see it through. I don't hate it. It's just that, like, I'm not really kind of engaged anymore. And, that, like, after how good the fifth season was, I'm just not as invested anymore. And I'm just kind of watching it to have something to watch while I'm, like, playing Magic Arena. by the way, Magic Arena is, you know, quite good. But that's maybe a subject for another time. Yeah, and I've been playing Super Mario Maker 2. You know, Mario Maker 1 is, I love that game. Mario Maker 2, also love it. You know, there's some caveats with how Nintendo has handled it. I think, like, they've been a bit hostile to the community. You know, they've removed some glitches that, you know, the community really made use of in the first game, and they didn't remove some glitches that were, like, actually bad game-breaking glitches. And also, they, like, you know, they didn't really engage the community when designing the game. So it's still, like, really tone-deaf. The ability to, like, search levels is bad. The level recommendation system is bad. And, hey, I would know. It's my job. Like, yeah, I work on a recommender system for my job, by the way. So, yeah, and, like, the way that you, like, some restrictions on uploading or downloading levels and, like, whatnot is just, like, just why? There's, like, no reason for it to be that way. And, like, this, like, comes off as unnecessarily hostile to the community, but beyond that, like, it's great. There's just so much you can do with it, like, so many new items that are much more kind of interactive items with each other. And, you know, the community around it has been fantastic. I'm just going to recommend a couple of... So, I will put my own Maker ID in the description, I guess, if I ever publish this episode. My levels are, you know... Either, like, I pick, like, one mechanic and I kind of, like, try to break it, or I love, like, troll level is not necessarily the kind of right descriptor, but I love kind of exploring levels where it's kind of this annoying exploration of an idea, like, taking an idea to the kind of logical extreme. So I have, like, one Getting Over It level, you know, inspired by the fantastic game Getting Over It with Bennett Foddy. It's just, like, these series of jumps that are really simple but really tight jumps, like, really hard to make jumps. And if you miss the jump, you, like, you don't get to redo it immediately. Like, you fall and, like, you have to, like, go back. So the idea is, you know, I love exploring the concept of frustration in game design in general. Like, because if you go back to, like, kind of a topic that talks about analysis, like, frustration, like, on paper, sounds like frustration is always bad, right? But if there was no frustration, there would be no satisfaction, I think. Like, because the logical extreme of no frustration is, there is no challenge in your game. Like, the moment, like, in the shooter, for example, the moment you look at an enemy, they die. Enemies can never hurt you. You can never die, and the game is extremely short. Like, this is, like, tuning frustration down to the max, to the minimum, I guess. And what you end up with is, like, this uninteresting, garbled mess of a game. And obviously, if you make something too frustrating, then that is just unappealing. And what's interesting to me is the notion of kind of pushing the bounds of frustration. Like, how far can we push this before it becomes too much. And, like, for example, with getting over it with Bennett Potty, like, the game is, like, pure frustration. But on the other hand, like, you can never die, right? And if you, like, master the mechanics, there's, like, one mechanic to master, and it's just exploring that mechanic in depth. So, there's, you know, it's not complex, right? Like, some games are overly complex, and, or, you, like, you know, you can die, and it's just really frustrating. But, you know, the notion of exploring, like, one really simple idea and driving frustration, that is, like, super, super interesting to me in game design. So I have a couple of levels like that, the getting over it level. One level where I play with, like, blocks that kind of expand when you hit them. And if you, like, do it wrong, they will kill you immediately. So how do you kind of, you know, how many ways can you do this to make keep it interesting? Right? That's, like, one level idea I have. I like one Metroid-style level that's, like, not designed to be frustrating. It's just, you know, I love Metroid games. Yeah, and a few others kind of basically kind of exploring ideas and exploring frustration. Not all of them are super great, I think. Most of them are not good, but yeah. So I'll put my idea in the description. But the other thing I was going to mention was, you know, some YouTubers to recommend who do Mario Maker stuff. So Ryukahr, R-Y-U-K-A-H-R, is a YouTuber. He's like, I think he's like the highest viewer count streamer of the game. He is super, super good at the game. Like he has, but he's not like the most technically proficient at the game, but he's really proficient. And he does like what you call super expert runs, which is like the hardest difficulty of level, which often means like really poorly designed, like frustrating levels. And the way he kind of, you know, either like breaks those levels to like get through, or like how the levels break him because they're too horrifying, and like how he kind of approaches these levels is really interesting to watch. On the other end of the spectrum, there's a creator called Carl Sagan 42, and he's like a PhD chemist, biochemist. And he, like, analyzes the levels from, like, a really technical perspective. Like, he always plays levels that explore glitches. And he tries to, like, understand what makes them work and, like, how the mechanic works. And he, you know, he's not that technically proficient. He's still pretty good, but, like, he's not nowhere near as good as Ryukahr. And, again, Ryukahr, Carl Sagan 42, these two guys. So, like, it's really interesting because, like, if you're playing, like, if you made Ryukahr play the levels that Carl plays, you know, he'd do very poorly because he doesn't have, like, that much of an in-depth understanding of the mechanics. Whereas if you, like, made Carl play some of the super expert levels that Ryukahr plays, like, he would fail a lot because he doesn't have that intuition of, like, the expertise of, like, what the bad level creators do and how they kind of, how do you get around that. So it's really interesting to see, like, these different creators approach the game differently. And how varied the levels that the community creates are, that, you know, you can have these, like, completely different levels that still are challenging and interesting in different ways. And, oh, wow, this ties back to the whole conversation I had about Prog versus Chugbore. And some of the creators are Ceave Gaming, C-E-A-V-E. This guy purely just does, like, glitch exploration or mechanic exploration videos. He doesn't, like, play other people's levels for the most part. He just, like, explains how to do these glitches. Yeah, I think these are my favorite creators. So yeah, I mean, go check them out. And they, I think, are like, they're like a good introduction to like why I think Mario Maker is super cool and super interesting. And yeah, hopefully I was able to kind of convey to you why I love Mario Maker and why I find it to be like a really interesting game and a really interesting community. And this is really timely because I just made it to work. I am turning into the parking lot right now. So yeah, let me know how this went. Let me know if you were bored or interested. And thanks for listening, and bye.